You're listening to the Getting Smart podcast. I'm Mason Pasha. This episode is part of a series that highlights Indigenous leaders and education and unpacks their research, their leadership styles, their connection to place, and their identity. Together with my co-host Dr. Jason Cummins, we hope to spotlight the ways that the education system can and must learn from these leaders and their critical work. Jason, would you mind introducing yourself?
Yep, Jason Cummins, everybody, a member of Gebzalaga Nation. I've really been enjoying and I appreciate our visits we've had and just exploring Native American views towards education leadership and how those values and ethics are exercised within people's leadership and just the importance of education for all of our communities. And I'm really happy to have our guest with us today. I'll turn it over to him to quickly introduce himself.
I'm Julian Guerrero. I serve as the director for the Office of Indian Education, and I'm Comanche and Kiowa, and I hail from Lawton, Oklahoma. I do an incredible amount of work, but it's truly, every day is a gift in the work that we do in the Office of Indian Ed. So the Office of Indian Education is primarily K-12 education. However, we do have one of our programs that does work in the post-secondary education space. But really thinking about our portfolio of work is that primarily grant-making office. We exercise around $185 million to $195 million in grants every year. The lion's share of that money is mostly in formula grants, anywhere from $105 million to $110 million any given year, and then around $75 to $85 million in competitive discretionary programs. And those vary in nature. We have grants that focus on recruiting and credentialing new Native teachers, Native administrators. We have grants focused on building partnerships between tribal education departments to state departments of education. We have grants that focus on supporting local Native American language immersion programs, partial immersion, full immersion, dual language programs. We also have grants that focus on college and career readiness, helping develop the readiness portfolio for Native students across the country to enter the workforce, to return to school, to really focus on equipping Native parents with choice and the ability to, you know, work in any one of these programs is incredible.
You know, a lot of times I think when people think about, you know, entering education, we think of teachers or principals, superintendents. Yet in your role, you serve, I guess, alongside the larger structure of education. And to working alongside of you, I've really seen the expertise and the savvy you have. Tell us about that, you know, working to serve principals and superintendents, school districts, even state education agencies. And how has that experience been? And what would you say to some of our listeners who might be thinking of that type of pathway?
Yeah, it's really easy to get overwhelmed in all the different connections, whether from working in a tribe to working in a state environment to the now working at the federal environment. You know, I will say that my ability to be savvy, as you say, it has really been a product of being able to work at every level of government, local, tribal, state, federal. And, you know, it's just really equipped me with an ability to, you know, usher in partnerships, networking, being able to kind of view things from different perspectives. And the where I always start and when I build a relationship, new administrators in education. It doesn't matter what level, whether that's post-secondary or K-12, school soups or superintendents really have a general understanding that they want their Native American students to succeed, and they're interested on how to get there. And I think when you zoom out across the entire United States, one incredible demographic fact to understand is that out of 10 Native American students, 9 of those 10, chances are they are attending a public school that is not on the reservation, not in a Bureau of Indian Education institution. They're in a regular K-12 public school system. 1 out of those 10 are on a BIE school reservation area setting. So when we look at 90% of our Native kids out there in public schools, it behooves us to really ask the question of how can the system at multiple levels do better, coordinate better? Really, how do we instill the knowledge in practicing superintendents that, quote, every Native child has talents, end quote, full stop.
Julian, so much of what you were just talking about resonates with some of the work we've been doing around pathways and helping young people sort of find opportunity in their communities and around them. I think what you were talking about was kind of helping the educators and the administrators actually spot and encourage that behavior in young people. But I'm curious, are you also doing work on the other side of that with really like connecting young people to opportunities, helping present them with sort of like careers and additional information? And what does that look like, if so?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's no shortage of making headway and really trying to focus on sustainable opportunities in the various Native communities throughout the country. I think the greatest challenge is trying to kind of build a theme of what we call that across each of our tribal nations. Workforce development is nation building. So when you think about investing in Native youth, Native peoples, Native families, you have to view the work through nation building, that a tribal community is more than just a collection of housing. It's more than just a municipality. It's more than just brick and mortar institutions and pieces of paper. Nation building is being able to restore the language, restore the identities, restore the pride, restore, you know, the human elements of what it means for a nation to thrive. And giving youth opportunities and workforce is but one step in that, albeit a critical one, no doubt, but one step in many of that. And from the work that we do in the OIE, practically, we focus on grant making around college and career readiness grants. We call these NYCP grants, Native Youth Community Project grants. And they focus on a plethora of whether it's just exposing a Native student to a college campus or getting them connected with any one of the 16 career pathways and thinking about the various occupations that exist out there beyond what TV shows. I think we can all agree that on how much, certain occupations get the glamour and other ones don't really. We try to think about all the different sorts of pathways and occupations that exist just beyond those that get all the glamour. And, you know, thinking about how Native youth can also take in, it's not just a zero-sum approach, right? And what I mean by that is that focusing on career pathways, college pathways for a Native student cannot and must not mean that they put aside their culture and there be this loss still on top of the struggle with maintaining identity. They can happen at the same time. So the beauty of our programs and the challenge of our programs is to educate, prepare, and equip Native children with readiness, but then also cultural fluency, cultural identity, and really convincing our Native students that Indigenous ways of knowing are still alive, still thriving, and there's a lot of history out there, and there's a lot of different golden nuggets on how to get there. So it just depends on where a Native student is starting, and I'm convinced of it. You know, I see it every time I go back home to Oklahoma. You know, getting to go to different ceremonies or dances or just community events, hand games, you name it. I see young children talking, dreaming, having these visions. They just don't have the vocabulary to say it yet.
Yeah, there's so much to respond to in what you just said. Thank you for sharing. I think it's really what you're saying about the workforce in particular really resonates with some stuff we've been seeing when more intentional kind of companies have been shifting the frame from making the potential employees workforce ready. Instead, they're taking it on to become kind of employee ready. Like, it's really about adjusting this frame of like, how do we actually celebrate the people that are coming into this, which really aligns with your nation building kind of viewpoint, which I thought was beautiful. And to just sort of build on that real quick, I was doing some research on you before our conversation, and I found a kind of Q&A, it looked like, that you had done with the department, and there was a question of what is one thing you will never do again, and your response was basically about fully equating your self-worth with your job and just how much burnout you felt from that in the past. So I'm curious, on your own personal journey, when did this question of identity and much of the things you were just talking about as being like a necessary sort of support running parallel to work, when did that emerge for you and kind of help you with this realization?
Let me just say, I'm so lucky to have learned that professional lesson and have had those experiences and have come to that conclusion early on in my career. And it, having those experiences, not equating my self-worth to my professional title, was a product of falling prey to, you know, micromanagers who, when I sign up to do the job, to do the thing, I'm all in. I'm showing up every day. I'm dressing as if I'm going to go on to a press conference. I'm addressing the matter with realism. I go all in because working in not just Indian Ed, but public education deserves the highest amount of professionalism because it is the future, no doubt. And unfortunately, I learned quickly that, like most industries, there are different management styles, and I've had a spectrum of different managers and supervisors that I've worked under, and I've had very laissez-faire managers who said, "Julian, I trust you're doing what you're doing. Keep going." And I've had some that misinterpreted a lot of the work and or didn't believe that the approach that I was trying to convince them of was worth taking. And I think a lot of what I learned from that was I see that micromanagers have a tough time with letting go of their own professional ego and identity in that work. So when a micromanager, through their own ego, they're really holding on to their tethering of their title with their personal worth. Those two things are very closely tethered. They haven't separated the two. And then I notice that managers who are not so inclined to micromanage, they've somehow found the balance or the continual play between making sure that neither of the two merge together in whole. And once I figured that out, I was like, I'm never going to do that again. One, for my own mental health, right? As a professional in the field of public ed, If I'm not coming to the table fully mentally ready, and if I'm suffering, then the work suffers. The teams I work with suffer. The people that I encourage, I'm not as encouraging as hard as I want to encourage them. I get a bit passive, I'm not there, not in the game. And I think that ultimately, that's another thing I learned, is that for your own mental health, it's important, because that mental health also has physical ramifications. And as long as I work very hard to earn that biweekly paycheck that we get, I can sleep very soundly at night.
That's really great advice for anybody listening. And I'm stepping back a little bit, Julian, with the idea of nationhood. And I guess a two-prong question is, what distinguishes, Native American nations versus, a lot of our other minoritized populations? What's the nuance there in the approach to education, and what should some of our ed leaders know about that?
I would say the boiling point for what distinguishes Native identity as more than a race, because there are different camps of thought around this, but I would appreciate if listeners could know and educate themselves on this, on one of these things, and this to be true, that Native identity is more than a race. It is not just a box that is, I am American Indian, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian, or Indigenous. There's also, especially for Native populations, there is a federal trust relationship history, a very complicated history, but all that to say that there is a political relationship, and that goes beyond the race. And I think that because Native identity has been tied into race, that's just because of it. It's convenient on paper. It's a convenient data point on paper. But if policy change real things, like, that only tells us that we need to dig deeper than just race. We need to focus on the sorts of political, historical relationships of where everything began. And one essential step in that direction is to understand the existence of congressional treaties with the various tribal nations throughout the United States, and that at one time it was the policy of the United States of America to engage in treaties with Indian nations. And since, there was a taking away of the treaty making, however, there's one thing to know in the education field, is that treaties still, the ones that were fully ratified and adopted, those are still law today. They still hold the weight of being the law of the land. Wow. And many of them are not yet fully exercised. And I think that's what's so fascinating, because, when we think in spaces around, well, how can we get Native children excited about their identity, their purpose, their histories, their languages? The answer to me, this is just Julian, but the answer to me is it's right in front of many of our children. It's the treaties. And what, to your second question on what ed leaders should know about this, is that I'm very excited to say is that there are growing and early stages of depositories online where treaties are easily accessible, that can be read, that are cataloged. And I think a great challenge here is to think of it this way. Instead of trying to go grab the treaty to then interpret or translate it and give it to a child, this is a perfect excuse to build a relationship with the tribes in your area and say, I want Native students in our school district to know about treaties. And I want the tribes to be the ones shepherding that work. We have the space, we have the facilities, we have the interest. We want to get there. And in some spaces and in previous roles, you know, being a part of state and local level government, worked on a few areas where tribes were already trying to do that. And it's so powerful when you put a tribe in a place where they can fully exercise a sovereignty in public education. And treaties is another way that that distinction happens. So advice to ed leaders, do not forget or please educate yourselves on tribal treaty rights.
Wow, thank you. That was really thought-provoking and just really have a pathway or a reason to reach out to a Native community that we might be serving as ed leaders. And thank you for that. The Department of Education has approximately 17 programs that's inferred to fulfill educational treaty rights. That's from preschool to K-12 to higher ed and career and technical ed. And that explains a lot of why that is, because, you know, the federal government engaged with this treaty making, and that depository of treaties online. Is that through the University of Oklahoma, or who is that through?
Yeah, great question. There is an online database out of Oklahoma State University. If you Google OSU treaties, I'm pretty sure it'll give you a hyperlink that takes you to the right space. And maybe in the notes, Mason, I think including a hyperlink there would be really nice to allow the audience to go correctly. Yeah, thank you. I will say that, you know, these treaties were engaged, ratified. Not all of them made it through to ratification. So I think that's another element of complexity, is that there are Native relatives of ours who are without a ratified treaty. So their approach to treaties is more that, hey, don't forget, you know, there are treaties that didn't make it to ratification, but those promises were still made. Those exchanges still happened. We want to be heard and be visible in this work. I say all that to say that there is roughly an estimate that 130 plus treaties have education provisions or promises in those treaties. 130 plus, that's amazing. And they were written at a time that it wasn't written. These weren't written yesterday. These are, you know, many years ago, using language and syntax of many years ago. So there's unpacking to do and analysis to be had and historical comparisons to make. But I think I think the next steps in building an awareness that tribal treaty rights exist in public ed, I think the next step is trying to figure out how the treaties can be interpreted and the canons of construction that which these treaties are interpreted are in favor of sovereignty. Because when you take a step back and you look at public education again, education is to help build people, help build futures that are free and open, and help instill new knowledge and impart better knowledge from one generation to another. And when we think about investing in tribal communities, and we want to improve education for tribal communities, you know, what better way to set the stage and to say, these are the treaties that we know are applicable for this community, and we want to be a part of the restorative narrative here. I think that's the chance, is that, you know, there are different ways that the context can be set when you look at this work.
Yeah, I was surprised when I looked up, you know, and those are just the known treaties that were entered in the database, and they're there's probably a lot of others out there, but I looked at my own tribe in education, and there was three treaties that specifically spoke with educational provisions in there. And they weren't written yesterday, but in the context of history, I like to think about generations. So they were like, they were written like two grandpas ago, you know? So that's not way, right. way back. It's fairly recent. And one of the provisions just in our situation was for every 30 students, the federal government was to provide a school teacher and a school building. That was most likely back with one-room school buildings, right? And so then what does that look like today? And so this is really thought-provoking in that our tribal nations did, in fact, pay for education in the form of land and other rights. So, yeah, thanks for speaking to that. I sure appreciate it.
That is fascinating information. So, yeah, super grateful for the share there. I'm curious, Julian, just as we kind of start to follow this conversation after some of those great moments to what might be a close, I don't know. we'll see. But I'm curious what's on your mind these days? Like, what are you thinking about? What is, what's something that the education, I would say that our audience is primarily concerned with maybe education innovation, to put it in quotes. So really thinking about new learning models and how to reimagine the learning system. Like, what are you thinking about on that tier, I guess?
When I am tackling some of the more challenges in front of my face, they usually fall into three buckets. And the first one is really around like diversity as strength bucket. I find the second is like recruitment of talent. And maybe modifying a little bit of that to say recruitment and retention. And then I think the third bucket I'd say maybe is teacher leadership. And those three are the kind of at the forefront of my more immediate work this year. So if I'm just thinking about what's on Julian's mind from now to the next 6 months, already thinking about being in calendar year 2024, I just got through being a part of a session to start thinking about fiscal year 2025. And then somebody mentioned we need to start thinking about 2026. And I'm like, hold on, we're in 2023. How in the world can we already be trying to think about 2026? But anyways, back to those three buckets, diversity of strength. I'm also going to throw another data point out there for the listeners that there are 574 federally recognized tribes. Other estimates approximate an additional 50 to 60 state recognized tribes on top of that number. And that doesn't count terminated tribes and or tribes who are still pending other recognitions. So I think nonetheless, let's just say 600 plus tribal affiliations. You know, Comanche and Kiowa are two separate tribal affiliations. I'm two of 600 possible affiliations out there. And there are many. That sense of diversity, when we think about the very important and critical challenge of supporting Native American language learning, not everyone can see that yet. Not everyone thinks, well, because there's a small amount of resources, we need to focus where we can see the immediate wins. We can need to focus on the low-hanging fruit, or, you know, there's just not enough resources to do anything. So we just need to continue asking for more resources. I think in a lot of respects, nobody's entirely wrong, but I do think that a lot of things can be done to support our language work through the diversity that we have in our populations. And a call for unification. You know, there's there's American Indian and the Continental 48 or the contiguous 48 states. And then I never want to forget about my native Hawaiian relatives and my Alaska Native relatives as well. I'm trying to think about how diversity serves us in building those lines of connection are important. To that second bucket on recruitment and retention of talent, we have recruitment programs. Our grantees work to identify scholars to get them recruited and credentialed and placed in high-density Native American school districts to do a service payback in their program. And beyond recruiting new talent, I feel that we should also pay particular attention to retaining our existing talent who, quite frankly, are seeing a lot of this work and have already shepherded many years into the system and still need to be supported. And there are various retention strategies and recruitment strategies that I would want the OIE to be a resource collector at the table to disseminate and distribute promising practices across the nation, and to really think about how we can recruit new talent to Native communities and keep talent within the Native communities. Albeit, yes, we can probably, we want our Native talent to go elsewhere, but we don't want them to stay elsewhere. We want them to come back and give back to the community. But again, that second bucket is thinking about our talent that we have in our communities, recruiting it and retaining it. And the third one on the teacher leadership piece of it, along the lines of what you mentioned, Mason, on models, and something that I've been interested in that I'm kind of new to is the teacher leadership models, and as a method of retaining and keeping existing talent is really equipping teachers with leadership opportunities and, you know, learning about what that means and learning about how that can really increase longevity and how that can also really incentivize growth for a practicing teacher. And I really want to learn more about this. So I make this a third bucket because this is something that I'm interested in seeing how it's teacher leadership, but then it's also thinking about all the other factors that impact that leadership or get in the way of a teacher being able to have that leadership.
Yeah, I got a comment and a question, and please. We were fortunate to work together this year, Julian, and I was always amazed at just the high level of talent that we were able to work with. And one individual that comes to my mind is Adon Gonzalez from Dallas, and he's the executive director of the Poydin Network, and I think I said that right. And he was a White House fellow, and just mentioning one of the pathways currently that's out there right now is I received some information from Kevin Lavery, and they want to reach out to make sure we try to get some Native American White House fellows. So wanted to put that out there on the pod today for anybody listening that has some promising students that want to get a feel for the type of work that you're in with the Department of Ed. And any quick advice for any college students who want to serve their communities through education, but not as a teacher or principal, and do some government work like you do?
Oh, yeah. Three things off the top of my head. Subscribe to the various channels out there. There's a great organization, a nonprofit called the Society of American Indian Government Employees, or SAGE. They push a lot of opportunities out there across different agencies for natives who want to get involved in government work at the federal level. And I think that they've always been a champion at uplifting those opportunities. I think the advice for college native students, without a doubt, networking. It's been a part of it's a part of the equation of success in my life, is that networking aspect. My formal background is not in education. My training is in public administration. My bachelor's is in public affairs and administration with a master's in public administration. I'm a believer in making government more efficient and making government more accountable, transparent, human, communicative, accessible, meaningful. And I think all of those elements of what you're interested in, like advice for a college student who has those same interests, keep them, never lose them, and volunteer your time, expecting nothing in return. Because when you enter those opportunities with that sort of spirit and that mentality, the rewards that you reap may not be immediate. It may be somewhere down the line, but I know I, Julian, have been a living testimony to this, and that I did a project and that connected me with a gentleman who so happened to be a executive director of a nonprofit that just so happened to get an NYCP grant from an office called the Office of Indian Education. And when it came time to be on the job hunt and knowing people and doing work, and he's like, "Hey, you want a job?" I said, "I would love a job." Volunteering, networking are two of the most valuable methods, and do it with a heart, not expecting any return.
Well, that was fantastic. That was not only a masterclass in the questions we asked, but kind of a masterclass in how to live. So, Julian, thank you so much for being here with us today and for your time.
Mason, Jason, thank you both. I really appreciate it. Yeah, let me come on camera real quick and wave to you guys. Thank you for the honor. Yep. It's always good to talk with you guys.
Yep, thanks for coming on. It was great.
Likewise.
Thanks for tuning into the Getting Smart podcast today. We want this podcast to be actionable, insightful, and a great way to learn about what's next in learning. In order to stay on the cutting edge, we need people in the field to tell us what they're hearing, what they're wanting, and what they're needing to learn more about. Got a topic or a guest in mind? Send your recommendations to me, Mason at gettingsmart.com. And if you like what you're hearing, don't forget to leave a review in Apple Podcasts or subscribe wherever you listen. Feel free to share the podcast on social media using the hashtag GSPodcasts. Thanks so much.